Most human problems can be solved with an appropriate charge of high explosive. Hello, my name is Will, and this is Exploding Helicopter, the podcast asking, are they all back? Now, during the 1980s, it was almost expected that the action heroes of the time would star in a film where they'd launch an unsanctioned mission to Vietnam to rescue American prisoners of war believed to be still held captive in the country. But before Chuck Norris went looking for the missing in action, or Sylvester Stallone asked if we were going to get to win this time, it was the more unlikely figure of Gene Hackman who first went in to get our boys back. So on this show, we're looking at the film that spawned an entire subgenre of the 1980s narmsploitation movie boom. It's 1983's Uncommon Valor. To help me review the film, I'm joined by a man who has been eating nothing but Vietnamese food, as I don't want him tramping through this podcast smelling like an American. It's Todd Liebenau from the Forgotten Filmcast. Welcome back to the show, Todd.
Great to be here. I fear I probably always smell like an American, but it's great to be back for another Hackman film.
Indeed, because the last episode that you were on, we were looking at another Vietnam-flavoured film, the Domino Principle, that starred Gene Hackman. But you know what? I was when I looked that up, Todd, I was shocked because that was 4 years ago, and I can't believe it's been 4 years.
No, oh my gosh. Well, I mean, we've podcasted together on other things, on my show and on other shows in that in-between time. So, yeah, I mean, the longer I do my own podcast, the more I just get floored by, you know, like how long I've been doing it. So time goes quickly the older you get, and I am definitely getting older, so...
Well, I'm glad to be putting your absence from my podcast right with this particular show. So thank you for coming back to help me look at this one. Now, Uncommon Valor, part of the 1980s sort of narmsploitation movie boom where, you know, you had films like Platoon, Casualties of War, Hamburger Hill, these sort of big Hollywood films looking at that subject matter. You also then had countless numbers of straight-to-video titles. You know, those films, or the films I've just mentioned, tended to focus on the experience of the conflict, you know, perhaps its physical and mental impact, or perhaps it examined moral and ethical questions about that conflict. But as I mentioned in the intro, this one is part of a subgenre of films which examined the issues of the missing in action or the prisoners of war. And, you know, I've always found that this particular sort of subgenre, you know, quite interesting because it's all based on a myth. And, you know, I mean, this is one that's been, you know, documented in government reports, in, you know, magazine articles, books and so forth. And, you know, from what I sort of seem, from what I understand, it sort of largely stems from sort of some Nixon government chicanery where they specifically sort of reclassified people who would have been considered killed in action as missing in action in a bid to try and turn public and world opinion against the North Vietnamese, and then ended up creating, you know, the law of unintended consequences in a sort of environment where this idea of hundreds, thousands of prisoners of war still sort of existing within Southeast Asia, becoming rooted in people's minds, and later efforts to clarify what happened to people then became just seen as part of a sort of a big cover up. And you know, I'm obviously a British person, sort of looking at this topic from afar. Obviously, yourself, you're much closer to the subject matter. What are your sort of reflections on the grip that this issue had on the minds of at least some in the American public?
I do remember it being a thing. I mean, I am someone that was born during the time of the Vietnam War, so it wasn't, you know, fresh in my mind as a young child, but as I entered my teenage years in the 80s, you know, certainly this was a topic that we heard a lot about. You know, we had teachers that were talking about the subject a lot. And I think part of it, as I look back now as a 50-something-year-old man, I go, well, you know, my teachers at the time were either ex-hippies or ex-vets themselves. You know, I probably had teachers that were on both sides of the, you know, the perceptions about the war. And, you know, so the Vietnam War would come up in discussions all the time, you know, when you're a high school student in the 80s, and certainly the concept of the missing in action would come up. I'm sure partially fueled by movies like this that started to come out throughout the decade. But yeah, I mean, it was just always kind of something that was there in the back of our minds, you know, just this idea that, yeah, who knows how many are still there type of a thing. And, you know, we obviously didn't know the full details at the time. You know, we were teenagers and we were just going by what we're being told and by what we see on the screen. So, you know, I definitely remember that mindset of just thinking that, oh, the war is only over for some, you know.
And I'm a little bit younger than you. I'm in my late 40s. I remember this issue being around in the sort of the public consciousness. What's interesting for me now, being older and being more aware, is that I guess I sort of trusted or believed, well, maybe there is something in this. Whereas now, I mean, it's if you go back and look at the subject, it's just essentially something that is a conspiracy theory. It's not based on any fact, yet it just, I mean, we live sadly, we sort of continue to live in an age, I guess, of conspiracy theories, if not perhaps an even worse one. But it's sort of fascinating how this sort of exerted such a grip. I mean, I was, some of the prep I was doing for this, I was reading about, you know, funnily enough, it was happening, taking place at the time that this film came out. There was a former Vietnam veteran who called Bo Gritz, who was basically doing kind of privately funded missions in Southeast Asia in order to look for prisoners of war. Now he never found any evidence that any of them existed. And you know, certainly some people have questioned quite what his motivations there, because a lot of his missions seem to be involved selling branded T-shirts and you know.
He's the guy that was responsible for all the Bart Simpson T-shirts back in the day. No, I just want to know, that's a great name. I mean, why haven't they actually used the name Bo Gritz in one of these, you know, Bring Him Back Alive movies? Because that sounds like a name that should have been used in one of these films.
Well, I think there are some unfortunate... Bo Gritz's life took some interesting turns, and that's a bit of a euphemism, sort of later on in the 80s. He ended up standing as a running mate with David Duke
cancel everything I just said. Yeah.
And he's then sort of fallen in with some various other like conspiracy groups. So I think, yeah, he's I don't think anyone particularly wants to sort of make any allusion or associations with that particular figure. But yeah, that was his mission was or kind of one of his sort of efforts in that part of the country was happening just as this film came out, which I guess, you know, speaks to the idea of this being a sort of hot button topic at the time of that it came out. Anyway, that's all, I guess, by way of context. So why don't we get stuck into the film itself? But before we do that, let's listen to how many times Trainer Man can say "for it."
They planned for it. They trained for it. And now, 6,000 miles from home, behind enemy lines, seven men go for it.
Let's go!
They had one way out, one chance to get their buddies who were left behind. Seven men with one thing in common. Uncommon valor. Be there. Rated R.
Now playing at a theater near you. Check newspapers.
Gene Hackman plays an army colonel who puts together a ragtag team of soldiers to rescue his son, who he believes is still held captive in Laos following the Vietnam War. Frustrated by years of American government inaction on searching for MIAs, Hackman recruits a group of former soldiers who all serve together with his son. To whip them into shape, they're joined by Patrick Swayze, who is the son of a soldier who went missing in Vietnam. The US government, fearing that the renegade op is going to jeopardize international relations, tries to sabotage Hackman's mission, forcing our heroes to, in the famous words of the Marine Corps, to improvise, adapt, and overcome. In the cast, which is a very interesting assemblage of talent we've got here.
Oh, I had no idea. I mean, I thought we were just talking about a Hackman movie, and I'm like, oh, look at all these people.
Indeed, yeah. We got it's a real hodgepodge. So we got Hackman, Fred Ward, Red Brown. We got the boxer and martial artist and sometime actor Randall Tex Cobb, Patrick Swayze, Tim Thomason, and Robert Stack, not to mention Michael Dudikoff in a small role. The film was directed by Ted Kotcheff, who, relevant to this discussion, made First Blood with Sylvester Stallone. It's also interesting to note that the producers of this film were John Milius and Buzz Feitschens, two characters with strong links to films about Vietnam. So Milius obviously was the screenwriter on Apocalypse Now, and Feitschens was the producer on First Blood. It was based on a story by the great Wings Hauser, although I think Wings Hauser believes he should get more than a story credit, but he thinks Milius did him over on the credits for this film, but that's another story. Uncommon Valor didn't get great reviews, but it was a box office success, grossing back over three times its £11 million budget. Looking at it now, Uncommon Valor has a 6.3 user rating on IMDb and a 3.1 out of 5 user rating on Letterboxd. So with all of that out of the way, Todd, what did you make of Uncommon Valor?
Well, this was my first time seeing the film. It's one that I'd been aware of, but just never got around to. I have vivid memories of the poster art image for this. I'm sure I probably saw it as like a cardboard stand-up in a movie theater lobby, probably when I was going to see my sixth or seventh viewing of Return of the Jedi, something like that. You know, it has this iconic image to it. So I don't know why I never got around to it, but I liked this film quite a bit. It's interesting to think that, you know, this is the start of the, you know, the missing in action kind of subgenre type of a thing here. And to think that Gene Hackman is the guy kicking it off. I mean, it's got a lot of the things we like to see in those types of movies where we're used to seeing, you know, Sylvester Stallone or whoever, but having Gene Hackman as the lead kind of, I don't know, has this way of giving it a little bit more seriousness, which may not be totally warranted because it's, you know, it's still a movie about, you know, let's train a bunch of misfits and get into the jungle and blow things up, you know. So I mean, if Gene Hackman wants to do that, I'm down for it. But like I said, one of the things that really grabbed me about this was I was just like, oh, I mean, not only do you have Gene Hackman, one of my favorite actors of all time, you've got all these other people who are ones who make me pay closer attention when I notice they're in the cast of a movie, you know, Fred Ward and Patrick Swayze. And I mean, I love the weird charm that people like Tim Thomerson or Randall Tex Cobb bring to a movie, you know? So it was great to see all those guys in this film and, you know, to have them team up. I say it time and time again on podcasts, I'm a sucker for team up films, you know, where you get all these weird people together. Maybe that stems from my love of the Muppets. I don't know. But, you know, when you have a unique cast of characters and they've all got to band together for one mission, that's my sweet spot. So, yeah, Uncommon Valor has a lot going for it for me. I mean, I won't say that it pulls off everything super well, but it is satisfying enough.
Well, you mentioned something there, which I thought was quite interesting. It's something that struck me on this rewatch was, you know, you talk about, you know, the fact that you've got Gene Hackman here, which lends this film a certain sort of seriousness. And I guess I wondered what you made of like some of the tone here, because Hackman, obviously, you know, a proper dramatic actor with, you know, some proper acting chops. So you've got him in the lead here, and you know, he's playing this character who has been looking for his son for 10 years, you know, who's been thwarted by government bureaucrats. He's been kind of ripped off by people in Southeast Asia who are just exploiting the fact that he's trying to find his son. So on the one hand, there are elements of this film which are quite heavy, which are, you know, a man carrying the weight of the loss of his son. Yet on the other hand, you've got the film that you mentioned there, where, okay, let's get a bunch of misfits together and get them in the jungle and blow stuff up. And, you know, there felt to me a little bit of tension there between sort of two different films where you just thought maybe they should have picked one lane or kind of, you know, or maybe at least leaned towards one lane, maybe over the other. I don't know. Yeah. How did that element strike you?
I get that viewpoint. It didn't bother me, really. I think, I guess part of it is I'm just so on board for anything that Gene Hackman brings me in a movie. So, you know, if we're going to spend a bunch of time doing some silliness, you know, with our crew of you know, ex-veteran or, you know, former Vietnam veterans, you know, and then every now and then, oh yeah, here's Hackman to kind of bring things back to a little bit more of the real world. You know, that's fine with me, but I don't know. I guess I would say, you know, maybe part of that, you know, the kind of warring between two different tones here is just the fact that, you know, this is kind of the first salvo for this genre, you know, and so they're kind of feeling their way still. You know, maybe the idea here is they're thinking, okay, well, we can't go too overboard. We have to be respectful. We have to, you know, we have to make it so that we're not, you know, doing something that is in some way negative towards these vets and what they went through. So, you know, they're going to satisfy our need for explosions and whatnot, but still try to keep it a bit more serious and like, you know, we understand that it was difficult and we don't want to dishonor you guys, you know?
I would agree with that because I actually watched this film twice in prep for this film. And I think on the first rewatch I did, I was more bothered by the tonal shifts. And actually on the second time, it didn't bother me as much. And but there are a few points where I do think it is a bit, where the storytelling is a bit lumpy. I mean, I don't know what you made of Hackman's sort of recruitment sequence of the team, because he largely just sort of barks at most people and just right, sort of browbeats them into coming along on this mission. And I guess the idea is, well, I'm not really sure what the film was trying to sort of say, why these people agree. Like, are they looking for redemption? Are they looking to exercise their demons? I felt the one recruitment scene that really worked, and it stands out because I think it did work, is where he recruits one of the pilots, Johnson, who's now working as a hospital administrator, or he seems to be running this hospital. And there's a bit of a longer scene there, and kind of Hackman, I guess, is appealing to his sense of honor, his sense of professional soldierly pride, because he reminds him of the sort of the soldier he once was. Whereas some of the other scenes, I mean, for instance, Blaster, I'm not sure why he agrees to go along.
I mean, a bunch of these guys, you kind of think, all right, well, I kind of get why you're going to go. I mean, like, Sailor, you know, I mean, yeah, he's, what else are you going to do, right? You know, but, you know, no, you're right. I mean, Johnson, Harold Sylvester's character, you're kind of thinking, dude, you got it good now. Why on earth would you put yourself in this situation again? So, yeah, it's maybe a little half-baked with, you know, why all these guys decide to go. I mean, yes, the opening sequence, you know, sets up that, you know, they definitely went through a traumatic experience and left some men behind. And so, you know, that's getting at them. But like you said, really, it seems like the main motivating factor in why they go is, who on earth can say no to Gene Hackman, you know?
Talking of Hackman in this film, I wondered if there was like a longer edit of this film that might have existed, because, you know, there's some stuff that happens at the beginning of the film where we see, you know, we see him at different points during the 1970s. We see Hackman in 1977, then it moves to 1982, then it moves to 1983. And you know, these scenes are meant to demonstrate, you know, how long he has been searching for his son. But I was thinking about those scenes in relation to the very end of the film where Hackman is reconciled or kind of sort of meets his wife again after this mission. And the mission hasn't had a successful outcome for Hackman, it has for other people. It made me wonder, like, okay, this makes me feel like there were some scenes earlier in the film where Hackman's kind of dedication to trying to find his son would be like putting pressure on his marriage, and his wife is like, you know, you can't keep spending money, you can't keep spending all your time doing this. And you know, there is that moment of catharsis for them at the end of the film because they know ultimately the fate of their son. And so it made me wonder if there was some, made me feel like there was some stuff missing, because those scenes at the beginning with Hackman, they just, it's a weird way of showing, I felt, what he's been doing for a period of time.
I agree. I think the time jumps are awkward. Actually, as it started that way, I was kind of like, oh, well, this is interesting. I mean, maybe we're going to see a let's go back type of thing taking place still in the mid or late 70s. You know, I thought, well, that'll be different than what we see in like a Rambo or whatever. But then we jump, you know, to current day. And yeah, it does feel like there's some holes there. You know, it's all very condensed and very quick. And so you don't really get a full sense of just, you know, how much he's been just agonizing over this for a decade or so. And you know, how much time he's put into this and how much resources and the strains that it's put on his marriage. I did think it was interesting seeing some of the scenes where he is kind of like, you know, going off to other parts of the world and wheeling and dealing and talking to shady people and trying to get whatever information he can. You know, again, I thought, well, that's something different than what we see in some of these ones where it's just all action. You know, we see kind of the process of how are we going to get all the intel to go where we need to go and do what we need to do and all that. But the film doesn't linger on that stuff too much. And yeah, I mean, to what you're saying about the ultimate ending and the fate of the son and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I don't like to toot my own horn too much, but I think I kind of had it figured out not too far into the film.
What tips it off for you?
You know, I don't know. I maybe it was just, you know, the amount of time that they're spending with, you know, let's train the team and these guys that, you know, we knew before and all that kind of stuff that I don't know. I just thought, I don't know. It, there's too much going into this for it to all play out nicely at the end.
Mm. Well, that element did make me wonder about, I guess, the final bill for this film in terms of the human cost and was it worth it? Because some of the characters that we get to meet, you know, who go back to, you know, to rescue their buddy, they don't make it out. You know, when this film ended, I was left with a sort of sense of, yeah, was it really worth it?
Do we get a fair trade-off here? I don't know. I mean, granted, those guys that are in the prison, they've been suffering for 10 years and all that kind of stuff. But still, I mean, you know, something deep inside you cries when, like, Reb Brown or Ramble Tex Cobb doesn't make it to the end of the film, you know?
Exactly. Although I thought that I felt that they were interesting choices for the people to pay the ultimate sacrifice, because I mean Blaster, God bless him, I think we all know he's probably not coming back alive from this, in terms of how he's presented. We've watched enough of these films to know he's gonna probably not be returning back.
And and Sailor too. I mean, you know, just the fact that he has a grenade at all times around his neck that he wears like it's, you know, the medal that, you know, they gave to Luke Skywalker or whatever, you know, it's, you know, that has to come into play at some point. And, you know, even though you don't want to see Sailor not make it, you know that if this thing that we're seeing dangling there through the whole movie is not used in some kind of just amazingly dramatic way at the end of the movie, you're not going to be, it's not going to have been worth the ticket price for you. You know, it was a given that something had to happen with that.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it felt like it would have been too, if say for instance, Fred Ward had, you know, bitten the bullet, or, you know, Harold Sylvester's character had bitten the bullet. It felt like that would almost be too much of a, they'd be the wrong characters for them to be, you know, because, you know, they'd be leaving behind a grieving wife who's going to run the hospital now. That, like, I don't know, I felt like Though I think Sailor and Blaster had, unfortunately, had the least stakes in life, and so were easy collateral damage to pay the price here.
And of course, too, I mean, when we're talking about, you know, the folks that don't make it out, one of the things that struck me, too, you know, that is a little awkward for the film is that, you know, of course, they pad out our team here once they get into Laos, you know, because we end up with a small group of locals that go along with them, and several of them don't make it out. And it's kind of like you almost feel like, okay, did they just add these folks so that they could up the cost? We could have more of the heroes die, you know? I mean, that's just, it doesn't sit very well, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely a lumpy, bumpy moment, I think, in the film. It speaks to, I think at some points there's a sort of uncertainty of tone here that the film hasn't sort of fully reconciled what sort of story ultimately wants to be telling, whether you just want to have a mission with, you know, some, you know, your classic ragtag group of characters who go in, blow stuff up, or whether you want to have something that is a bit more of a meditation on the horrors of war or something. So, but, you know, we talked about the cast of characters here quite a bit. And as we've already said, it's a very interesting, very eclectic group of actors here. How do you think they work together? Who caught your eye for good or bad?
Well, I they work together really well. I mean, I think part of that is we get a lengthy training sequence, basically. I mean, this was before we had the official type of training montage type of thing. Well, I mean, I guess Rocky really brought us the training montage. But I mean, here you can't call it a montage. It's more of a sequence, you know, because it's not set to music or whatever, you know. But we get all these little bits where they're doing these things that you kind of look at them and go, all right, I don't know how effective that is for what the mission at hand is, but it's, you know, fun to watch, you know, carry logs around, you know. I love the bit with Fred Ward stalking everybody and, like, he's got to tag you before you get back to the base or whatever, you know. That was a fun sequence. But the characters, I think, are a lot of fun. They work well together. There's, you know, there's good camaraderie. I don't know, you know, how it was, you know, in terms of on the set, you know, between the actors themselves, but they look like they're enjoying playing off of each other, and it works quite well. As far as standouts, I mean, it's so hard because I like so many of them. I mean, when Patrick Swayze shows up, I mean, I don't know. I just got to give some love to the Swayze. I mean, there's a lot of fun to be had, you know, where you've got the young guy who's kind of at odds with these guys who have actually been off to war, and they're kind of like, well, what are you doing here? Why do you care? And all that kind of stuff. And of course, he's got something invested in this as well, but you know, it's a nice precursor to what we're going to see Swayze doing in Red Dawn and such. So, you know, I thought that was a lot of fun. I love Sailor. I think, you know, just, I count myself as a Randall Tex Cobb fan, you know, whether it's Raising Arizona or Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol, yeah. Or, you know, I mean, I think he's a great presence. And this is a film where he really gets to shine. This isn't just a part where, you know, it's all about his build and his unique look. He's an actual, you know, interesting character in this. And, I mean, I love that actually the end credits start to roll on footage of him doing his little Tai Chi, whatever, against the sunset. You know, it's like, yes, bring me back Sailor at the end of the movie. But I mean, I could keep going. I mean, I think Tim Thomerson brings a lot of fun stuff in this film. Tim Thomerson is just a fun presence in many movies that he shows up in. And he's good as kind of the, you know, he's a bit of the comic relief in this, you know, so I enjoyed him showing up in this as well.
Definitely. Now, we should talk about the action that we get in here, because we get, as you mentioned, we get the kind of extensive training sequences, we get the infiltration into Laos, and then we get the big raid on the POW camp. So yeah, how did you find the action in here? You know, do you think that it stacks up against some of the films that would come out after this in the sort of, you know, rescuing the POW genres like your Rambos and your Missing in Actions? How do you think it stacked up against those films?
I mean, it doesn't, you know, just hit you in the face with the action as consistently as, you know, like a Rambo does. But it's got standout sequences with that at the beginning, at the end of the film. It bookends things very well. The training kind of carries us through the middle part. I think when it does get into the action, we do get some really spectacular moments. I mean, we're going to talk about the helicopters at some point here, but, you know, even beyond that, when we have the big raid on the POW camp at the end, there's some great moments. There's a moment where they blow up one of the huts, and it's just, I mean, the whole thing is just engulfed in flames and disintegrates. I was like, exploding helicopter, nothing. That's the exploding hut podcast, because that is amazing. Right there. So yeah, I mean, there's enough good moments there. With this being really one of the first entries in this genre, I don't think they're in the mindset yet of, well, we gotta just keep moving with the action, with the explosions and such. But what they do give us of that, I mean, it starts the film with that, it ends the film with that. So it you know, gets us on the right footing at the beginning, and it leaves us with something satisfying at the end. So that, you know, that was enough for me.
And, you know, within that action, we get to see a lot of moments that would, I guess we would see over and over again in films of this ilk. And, you know, it may well be that this is the sort of foundational film for some of these tropes. So, I mean, at the beginning of the film, we get that sort of shot of our heroes running in slow motion across a paddy field to get into a helicopter. And, you know, that's a scene we've seen millions of times in these types of film. Get to see somebody leaping onto a group of baddies holding a grenade. We get the kind of classic, you know, somebody like enjoying or dancing to a classic bit of 60s rock. Somebody emerging out of the water to kind of, you know, surprise. You know, so all of these moments that would become sort of, yeah, standard tropes are all here in this, all present and correct in this film. And it might be the sort of first time they're put on screen. So I think it's interesting, if nothing else, for Uncommon Valor to have that as a status.
It would be interesting to, you know, like make a chart of some sort, you know, to kind of trace the track of the 80s, these types of films, and see, all right, you know, these things that we see in Rambo, in Missing in Action, in, you know, Strike Commando, what have you, you know, all right, can we see those in Uncommon Valor? You know, I'm sure there's a bunch of them that we can trace back to that. The importance of chopper fireballs in those type of movies. I mean, I'm sure you will dive into it more, but I got to think that having exploding helicopters is a essential element in a lot of these, you know, go back to Nam and bring them home type of movies, you know. So,
oh, it certainly is. It certainly is. And I think you've queued us up nicely, Todd. So why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we will look at the exploding helicopter action.
Two reckless FBI agents.
I can and I will fire you.
A desperate serial killer in search of revenge.
In his eyes, Uncle Sam committed treason against him.
We need a list of Dacey's potential targets.
Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Speaker of the House.
A final showdown you'll never forget.
I got a message for the rest of you feds.
It's Judgment Day!
Lorenzo Lamas, Gary Busey, and Roy Scheider star in an action-packed thriller loaded with suspense and the wrath of one man's anger.
We're back, and now we're looking at the exploding helicopter action. This film opens with a flashback to the Vietnam War. A group of soldiers race frantically across a paddy field under heavy fire to helicopters waiting to evacuate them. One of the choppers is hit by a mortar round and explodes in a massive slow-motion fireball. Todd, what did you make of the exploding helicopter action?
Well, first of all, I was thrilled that it came right at the start of the film. I was like, oh, wow, here we go. I mean, it's a great explosion. Like you said, it's in slow motion. It actually, it's like one of those things where it explodes in slow motion. They cut away to the reactions, and then it's still exploding when they cut back to it. And we see chunks of the helicopter flying towards the camera and things like that. So that's just great. It did throw me at first when I saw it, because all of our heroes, you know, these characters we're going to continue to be with through the rest of the film, are in a helicopter getting ready to take off. They're like, you know, calling to their buddies, come on, they don't want to leave them behind and all that stuff. And then we cut to this other helicopter and it blows up, and I was like, oh, is that the helicopter they were all in? Did they all just blow up? But no. I was like, but you know, I mean, the helicopter that explodes at the beginning of this film is a pretty spectacular explosion.
Yeah, they certainly didn't spare the pyrotechnics for that particular shot. Much like that hut that blows up later in the film. I mean, they really blow up the helicopter that they've secured for this particular scene. But you mentioned whether exploding helicopters are an essential feature of the, you know, going back to NAMM movies, and certainly a lot of them do feature exploding helicopters. So you know, Rambo: First Blood Part 2, that has an exploding helicopter in. All three of the Missing in Action films feature an exploding helicopter, and David Carradine also got into the act of, the kind of...
POW, the escape.
Correct, yes. He also gets in on the act there as well. So it is a trope that they like to get into those films. But there is a matter, an important matter. We shouldn't get too segued here, that I wanted your help to adjudicate on here, Todd, because when I first logged this film some 12 years ago, I considered it to include two exploding helicopters. However, on this rewatch, I'm not convinced that I should actually count two exploding helicopters. So there's a second sequence that takes place in here, and It's during the rescue of the POWs when Tim Thomason's helicopter is hit by gunfire. We see sort of flames inside the fuselage of the helicopter whilst it's still in flight, and then it crashes into the river. Tim Thomason, rather incredibly, manages to escape from this helicopter crash. But yeah, Todd, what was your verdict? Should it count as an exploding helicopter?
See, when I first saw it, I was like, ooh, we get a second one, you know, and then I did kind of think, all right, does this count or not? Because I don't know exactly your criteria. I mean, you know, if somebody survives, you know, does that, you know, does that make it not as much of an explosion? I did like this one. I thought it was cool because it's in the air and, you know, the thing just kind of goes limp, which I thought was interesting. It was like, I mean, suddenly, you know, it's not like a helicopter, it's like this charred limp noodle flying through the air, you know. And I was like, well, this is kind of cool, you know. And of course my first reaction was, oh no, are we gonna lose Tim Thomason, you know? And then he survives, you know, which I'm like all down for that. But I don't know, I think in the end I kind of did count this as a second one, because I think it when it happened, it grabbed me and I was like, all right, that's cool, that's a little different than what I usually see with most exploding helicopters, because you've trained me, man. I look for them. I am like always like, all right, we gotta see how this stacks up. So I think in my mind, I did end up counting it.
You know, I'm supposed to be the scholar of the exploding helicopters, and I find myself in great difficulty with this film. I go backwards and forwards on it, and I think the fact that Tim Thomason survives counts gravely against the fact that this is an exploding helicopter, because how on earth do you survive a helicopter that has exploded? But I think I'm going to leave it as two, and then later scholars may wish to upbraid me on my lax standards. But there you go. Okay, well, for the moment, Uncommon Valor, two exploding helicopters. Okay, well, I think that just about wraps things up for this show. Todd, thank you for joining me once again. Before you go, do you want to take a moment to plug your own show and what you got going on online?
Oh, absolutely. I'm always happy to plug the Forgotten Filmcast. So that is my podcast. We are always releasing episodes. We talk about the movies that time forgot. So the ones that just don't get a whole lot of attention. You know, we've covered things from the silent era all the way up to the early 2000s kind of is my cutoff point these days. You know, just the films that have kind of flown under the radar. You know, sometimes they're movies that were big at the time that, you know, just people don't seem to revisit them much. Other times they're things that never had a big audience to start with. Will has been on the show several times. Hopefully he will be on several times more. He's one of my go-tos. So, actually, oddly enough, another hour or so from now, I am recording an episode of my show that you'll be able to check out soon for a film that does feature an exploding helicopter. I am going to be joined by my friend Toby Roan, who just published a book that he wrote all about the making of Clint Eastwood's The Gauntlet. And so that has quite an exploding helicopter in it. And we're going to be talking about that film on an upcoming episode of my show.
A very interesting film, one that we reviewed on my podcast a little while back. So I'd be fascinated to listen to that discussion, and especially to hear Toby's thoughts on the film, given that he's spent so much time and energy thinking about the film in depth. So yeah, be very interested to hear what he's got to say about that. As always, don't forget to check out the Exploding Helicopter website for more reviews and information about films where helicopters explode. If you could help spread the word about what we're doing by rating, reviewing, or retweeting us, we'd be very grateful. We'll be back soon, but until then, what should people do, Todd?
Keep watching the skies for those exploding helicopters.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Well, that's it. It's game time.
I had a speech prepared, but I guess I forgot it. There are some lines from Julius Caesar. If a man were to know the end of this day's business ere it come, but it suffices that the day will end, and then the end be known. And if we meet again, well, then we'll smile. And if not, well, then this parting was well made.